Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer Bill Smith. First of all, the news came a couple days ago that Warner Music Group had the most albums in the top 50. Now, you'd think that it would be Universal since they are the largest and they have the largest market share. But no, it was Warner's with 20 out of the top 50. The interesting thing about this is there's actually a lot of familiar faces, and you wouldn't think this, but it's more of the classic artists that are selling than the newer artists when it comes to albums anyway. So for instance, Metallica came in at number 4, and they only sold 2.1 million albums. Considering that Beyonce was number 1 with 2.9 million, that's not that far off. If you look down the list, there's also a lot of other familiar faces. Bruno Mars, Coldplay, Michael Bublé's on there twice, Prince, Red Hot Chili Peppers, David Bowie, Blake Shelton, Green Day. So there's a lot of very familiar faces here. And what that tells us is the fact that albums may be something that's generational. So what that seems to tell us is that albums are being bought mostly by baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, but as we get down below 30, they just don't care all that much about an album. Now, you can tell by these numbers, they're not really high. So in other words, we're looking at Metallica here. They came in at number 4 last year with 2.1 million sales. Now, 2.1 million sales is not physical sales. It's a combination of physical and digital and everything else. This is a total of 2.1 million albums. Gee, a big artist used to sell that in a week, and now we're going a whole year, and that's all we get. So it makes one think, why would anyone spend time on an album if not many people are buying them and not many people care? You're so much better off to just concentrate on song by song by song. Do a song, finish it, get it out. Do a song, finish it, get it out. We're in an era of singles. Singles matter. That's what people listen to. They don't necessarily listen to albums. Maybe if you put it out in vinyl and you have a number of people that will sit and listen to the vinyl, maybe that's worth it. But chances are there's not enough of them to even make that worth your while. So I hope that artists begin to understand that the album is not where they should go these days. All the evidence is against it. Everything is saying that the album is basically dead. Many of us just don't know it yet. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. If you want to learn more about the basics of mixing, sign up for my 4-week Music Mixing Primer webinar course. Go to mixingprimer.com to learn more. Also, check out my new Hitmakers Club to access a powerful online group, all of my courses, monthly workshops and Q&A webinars, core basic training, and much, much more. Go to hitmakersclub.com to find out all about it. Also in the news last week was a company out of Montreal, actually the University of Montreal, called Lyrebird, L-Y-R-E-B-I-R-D. And what makes them interesting is it's an artificial intelligence company, but they can imitate anyone's voice. So in other words, all you have to do is type in whatever you want them to say, and you can have the voice of anybody else saying it. What makes it even more interesting is you can control the design of the voice, you can control the emotion. It never sounds the same way twice. Just as a human, if you were to say the same sentence over and over, you'd have different inflections. And that, in fact, is what Lyrebird also does. It's very interesting. If you go on the site, which is lyrebird.ai, that's lyrebird.ai. If you go on the site, they have a very interesting demo of Obama, Trump, and Hillary Clinton having a conversation with one another. And the fact of the matter is, none of them were ever in this conversation. So this is kind of interesting, this technology. Already radio stations are looking into this. What they plan on doing is taking the voices of their famous DJs, past and present, and using something like this, using this artificial intelligence to replace them. So the most expensive person in a radio station many times is the DJ, and that won't be the case anymore. So here we go. It's another case of automation replacing the human being, and in this case, a creative human being. Don't like it, but it's happening. It's the way of the world. Nonetheless, the technology is very, very cool. lyrabird.ai. My guest today is engineer Bill Smith, who was in the enviable position of watching some of the best engineers in the world during his time as an assistant at Capitol Studios in Hollywood. Then he became the personal assistant of the legendary Al Schmitt. Since then, Bill's gone out on his own. He's worked on a number of great albums, films, and television shows. His credits include Queen Latifah, John Fogerty, Christopher Cross, and Yes, among many others. I spoke with Bill via phone from his home in Los Angeles. I want to talk a lot about your career and a lot about Capitol, because you got a chance to see some things that most people haven't. How did you get to Capitol?
How did I get to Capitol? Well, moved from New York City to start with, right? I had started doing this in New York City. Moved out here from New York. First place I was working here in California was Cherokee, the old Cherokee Studios on Fairfax Avenue, which is unfortunately no longer there anymore. And just got wind of a job being available, you know, for an assistant engineer position over at Capitol, and thought, well, you know, let's try to move myself up here. And went over there one day, just, you know, out of the blue, got my resume together up to that point and went over there. I didn't really have an appointment or anything like that, just showed up and met Paula Salvatore and said, you know, I'd like to speak with somebody about the position that's available. And spoke with Paula for a few minutes, took a meeting right there at the time with Michael Frondelli, who was gracious enough and courteous enough to see me straight away since I was standing there in the office. Took an interview with Michael for whatever, 45 minutes or so, and 2 weeks later had the job. So that's pretty much all there really was to it. Just kind of showed up and talked to them, you know, and I guess that was enough to get me in. And thank God it was, because I had a great time working there.
Let's go back before that. When you first started in New York, how did you get into your first job?
The first job I had in this industry was at a studio on 24th Street in Manhattan called Secret Sound.
Oh, yeah.
And it was Todd Rundgren's old place, Todd and Moogie Klingman, right? Todd actually lived in a portion of the studio way back when, in the late 70s and early 80s, things like that. I started over there in 85, I want to say, right? I had, when I got out of college, right, Bob, in other words, I pretty much always knew what I was going to end up doing with my life. Since I was about 12 years old, you know, I never really considered anything else. It was going to be something in the creative musical vein. I thought originally that perhaps I would be a musician and play guitar and piano, which I still do to this day. But when I started to sort of scan around and listen to the quality of a lot of the other musicians, I quickly realized that, okay, you know, maybe you're not going to be a musician for a living, and it'll be more of a hobby type thing, right?
Yeah.
As I sort of compared my skills to some of the other guys I was hearing, and thought, okay, how can I keep my hand in the music end? How can I be creative? How can I still stay involved? And that led me to the engineering side of things. So when I was at college, I went to Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York, right, which is about 2 hours north of the city, right off the Hudson. I had started in my sort of third or fourth year of college hanging around a lot up at Bearsville Studios, which was only another 2 hours north of Poughkeepsie even, and got quite a good taste for it, just sort of hanging around there and seeing things and being allowed to sort of, you know, just ghost guys and answer phones, and got a good taste for it. After I graduated college, okay, the next month I enrolled at a school that was called at the time the Center for Media Arts in Manhattan, which was conveniently located on 23rd Street, about half a block away, up one and half a block over from where Secret Sound was. The instructor who was the instructor for the class I was in, was a gentleman by the name of Gene Perla, who was a bit of an engineer at one time in New York City and that kind of thing. I did the first 3 months of the class. It was supposed to be a 6-month thing. I did the first 3 months, and Gene said to me one day, he said, Bill, did you pay for the second 3 months yet? I said, no, I haven't made the payment yet. And Gene looked at me and said, fabulous, come with me. Okay. And walked me around the corner personally to secret, up the elevator to the 7th floor, walked me off, introduced me to the owners of the studio at that time, and pretty much walked me in and hand-delivered me my first job at a studio. I guess he, you know, had noticed or had figured out that after 3 months that I was so into it and maybe so far along in things, because I had already had that experience up at Bearsville, that taking classes about recording was a waste of my time at that point, and I would be better served just getting thrown right into it immediately. And that was literally how it happened, you know, by the grace of Gene and the grace of God. And like I say, obviously I must have impressed him enough that he did that for me. And it was a great favor and a great service. And I started at Secret Sound, as you do. You've taken out the trash and vacuuming up and answering phones and that sort of thing. I didn't get paid straight away, because back then, you know, in those days, you didn't necessarily walk right into a paying position, right? So I did all that kind of stuff. He approved myself that I was able to do all those things, showed up 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, that sort of thing. And after 3 or 4 months, I went into the office and said, guys, I work here now, and I need to start getting a paycheck. And they wholeheartedly agreed. And it just went from there. That was the beginnings of it, really. Very, very simple. And, you know, through the courtesy and grace of other people, it helped me.
That's very cool. Everybody has a different story about how they enter the business and how they got their first gig. That's an unusual one, I have to say. I don't usually hear people tell me that they get into the business that way. So it just goes to show you there are many, many different ways. There's no one way that it actually happens.
Oh, absolutely. There is no one way. And it also, to me, pointed out the fact that you always want to be giving 100% all the time, no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, okay? Because if I hadn't given 100% in taking that class at the Center for Media Arts and hadn't been totally committed to it, Gene would have never noticed me, right?
Yeah.
And he would have never walked me around the corner. And then if I hadn't given 100% in showing up 6 days a week, okay, for 10, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours a day, I hadn't completely given 100% and proved to the owners of the studio at that time, this is what I wanted, right? It wouldn't have led to picking up a paycheck.
Yeah, yeah.
Eventually. And I think all of that also relates to your first question as well. How did I arrive at Capitol? Same way. Right. You know, just constantly giving 100% and constantly always being ready to do whatever is required and having a positive attitude about it all as well. You know, a positive attitude combined with a willingness to move forward. And those two things are amazing what can happen to you.
Yeah.
When you give off those qualities.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that seems to be the one constant in the business, where you have to have a great attitude and you have to really be into it, and you can't be halfway. When it's all said and done, that overcomes a talent deficiency. I'm not saying you have that or had that, but, you know, a lot of times just by being there and being very enthusiastic, people will take you under their wings and really help you. So, and we all have mentors, and I want to get to yours because I know you've had a bunch here. Let's jump up to Capitol for a second. How long were you there?
I was actually probably one of the shortest employees Capitol Studios has ever had. I was 3 years from entrance to exit.
Oh, I thought it was more.
A very short period of time. No, people always think it was more because of the fact that even after I had left there after 3 years, I went from the 3 years there to walking right into working with Al Schmidt every day of the week. Right. And just through my constant association with him, when he would work there, I would go back with him. And even after I had left, Paula Salvatore would still call me. It wasn't a clean break, Bobby, like flipping a light switch. In other words, there was still an overlap period of months, a lot of months, actually. Where before Capitol got the next person on board full time, right? And they found who was going to slot in for that position, that I was already so in the well in the know with all the clients and everybody that for a while, Paula just kept calling me. And I basically worked on a freelance basis for a while. It's just an independent hire.
Yeah.
So people perceive it to have been longer than it actually was. Even to this day, however long it's been, 17 years later or whatever it's been, I still see a lot of the musicians and things. Bill from Capitol. They still sort of where they first met you, I think, right? Always, always sort of sticks in their brain. But no, it was very short. I was in and out, basically.
Well, let's talk about Capitol for a second, because it's one of the iconic studios anywhere, and the people that come through there are first class. So you must have picked up a lot from the various people that you had work with there. Who was most influential to you?
Al Schmidt, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt, hands down. Couldn't, right? As I've answered without hesitation, right? Absolutely,
yeah.
By far. He was by far the most influential person on me in terms of experience and at least in terms of how to do the job I do on a daily basis, right? The studio, working for the studio exposed me to many things I had never seen before. How to record an orchestra, how to record a big band, right?
Yeah.
How to work on sessions of that nature and that size, right? Everything I had done before that was, basically your sort of, smaller jazz dates, say 3 or 4 piece jazz dates or rock and roll dates, that kind of thing. Bands where you'd camp out for, again, in those days, you'd camp out for 2 months in the studio and work on a record. But I had never seen anything like the big band stuff, the orchestral recording, those kind of things. So the studio exposed me to that. Working with Al exposed me to how to record all of that kind of stuff and how to mix it, what's important in terms of all of those kind of things. An incredible amount of knowledge and experience in how to work with clients, what the job is really about, which is a service job, right?
Yeah.
More than anything, taught me an understanding of that. Even though we mix and record records and that's sort of on the surface, the service that we seem to provide, what the job really is helping people realize their dreams and their goals. That's really to me. And that working with Al was the first time I ever exposed to that mode of thinking as well, which is we're not here to mix and record. That may be the physicality of what we're doing. Is recording and mixing and overdubbing and doing all that. And we do that to the best of our ability, 100% at all times. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what we're doing is we're helping people realize their dreams for their music and what they have to get out of them emotionally through their music and what they're trying to express. And that opened my eyes a lot to just really what I do on a daily basis. A large portion of it, and people think it's, oh, it's the gear, it's the equipment, it's this, it's that. It's not. It helps, but it's not. It's your attitude, as we were saying before, right?
Yeah.
Positive attitude, right? Having a smile on, being happy to be there, okay? Nothing's a problem. You know, give me 5 minutes and I'll have that for you, right? And just being very upbeat, being very positive, being somebody that other people want to be around for 12 hours a day in a room with no windows.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That you become a positive influence in that manner, and that you're, and I agree with you 1,000%, what you said before, that even the attitude will outweigh the technical ability every time. Okay.
Yeah.
Especially when you're living in those kind of close quarters with people day after day for that length of time, people would much rather spend their time with someone who's pleasant, upbeat, has a smile on their face, right? Is happy to be there. If it takes them a couple of extra minutes to get something done, no problem. Okay. Because your attitude far outweighs somebody that can do it a little bit quicker, but it's a drag to be with them. It's a drudgery to be with that person all day. It affects the music. It affects people's attitudes. It's not what they're there to do. We're trying to lift people up and make it a positive experience. So they walk away thinking, God, what a great day.
Right, right, right. Well, let's talk about Al Schmidt for a second. I've spent a little bit of time around him in the studio, but very little. And one of the things that's so interesting is he makes it look so easy. He'll get a great mix and you'll go, well, you look at it and you go, wait, he really didn't do much here. How did this happen? And it's just so easy and fast. What did you learn from him? And just taking that as a jumping off point, because I'm sure you've seen it 1,000 times. How does he do that?
He does it because he's an incredible master at what he does. And he does it so well, and it's so second nature to him, that the appearance might be, oh, he hasn't really done anything. He's done a tremendous amount. He's done more than most people can realize, actually, which is the genius of Al that I learned was, get it right the first time at the source.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to spend all that time twisting knobs later, right? That if you do it properly, if you set up the band in the room the proper way, okay, if you choose the proper microphones for any particular application, that helps you enormously towards the end result. If the balances and the blends are correct when you record, that's less you have to do in the mix stage. The great thing I learned from Al is that you're always mixing, even from downbeat of the first tracking date for any particular song or record. You're always thinking about the end result.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening in the mix? I learned to be fearless from Al in a way. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're recording, don't be afraid to grab the microphone fader, move it. You know, if there's a trumpet solo that comes up in the middle of a big band chart, right? Lift it up as it's going into the tape machine. Make that move. Learn this. Listen to the song when the guys are running it down. Okay.
Yeah.
Or if you've got the ability, somebody in the room with you who's following along on a chart, who can call out, trumpet solo, lean over and lift it up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that it, you record that way. You don't, that's a move you no longer have to make in the mix.
Yeah.
Okay. Not only in the mix, it's a move you don't have to make every single time somebody wants to hear a playback. It's done. You've already, right? You're already thinking ahead. Same thing with vocalists and singers, right? Listen to them. Learn the song. Pay attention. That's the most important thing. Pay attention. Learn the song. Listen to the singer as they run it down the first time. Pay attention to where they get louder and softer, which 9 times out of 10 is always in the same spots, louder in the choruses, quieter in the verses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So game ride those things into the tape recorder or the, you know, back then 24 track analog or Pro Tools, whatever you want to call it these days, right? Whatever anybody refers to it. But if you do that, you're already mixing. Again, those things are things you don't have to do on the back end. Not only that, on the back end of things, you don't have to use things like compression so much.
Yeah.
You become a human compressor in a certain way, right? You don't have to level out the vocal on the playback through a compressor or sit there and, again, do the gain rides every time somebody wants to hear a playback. You've done it at the source. You know, that was an eye-opening experience to me, Bobby.
Yeah.
Okay? The concept of always be thinking at the end stage, okay, or the end game from the minute you first hit the record button instantly. And the concept of being fearless to do it, right? Because a lot of people would never do that. They, oh my, you know, I can't move the fader with the microphone on it. No, no, no.
Yeah, right.
Right? But I learned from him, be fearless. Don't be afraid. There's nothing you can screw up. All right. You're never going to blow it so bad that, you know, you can't correct it on the back end a little bit if there's any mistake involved to start with.
Yeah. That's an old school way of doing it. I'm not comparing it to anything, just saying that back in the day when Al started and you didn't have a lot of tracks to record on, you were doing everything live. So you got used to doing that. Unfortunately, most people don't have that mindset, that approach, because there's so many tracks available that they just don't think of live recording. The whole process of capturing things is different in the modern element. I'm not saying it's better or worse, it just is. So as far as you're...
It's different.
Yeah, it's different. So as far as you're concerned, now that you're out on your own, how do you approach things? Do you do things like Al did? Or do you find yourself taking and leaving and having your own way of doing it? A hybrid way, let's say.
I would think a hybrid way in many respects. Obviously, that approach that we were just speaking about, right? The constantly thinking about the mix and game riding things into the tape machine as they're going down. The concept of capturing a moment in time, which is really what he's doing. And you're absolutely right when you say it comes out of the old school tradition of we're set up the whole band and we're going to record this on a 3-track tape recorder.
Yeah.
Okay. Where there would be very limited mixing, if any at all, after the fact. You had to get it right as it went down live. I still approach things very much that way. Absolutely. You know, but maybe combined with a little bit more of, say, just the modern technology of it all, the Pro Tools and things like that, which I have to be a little bit more aware of, you know, just from, I'll take a lot of projects at this point because of clients' budgets and things like that, and I'll end up bringing them back to my studio here at my house, right, and continuing forward and doing overdubs and things like that here. But I still try to stay very much in that vein of what I learned from him, because I realized at the end of the day, it, for me at least, it really is the best way to do it. It really is the best way to approach it. It is the subtlety. That's one of the great things I learned from Al as well. Subtlety is key, right?
Mm-hmm.
That if you can achieve something through subtlety, it's far better to be subtle than to use a sledgehammer, right?
Yeah.
Sledgehammers don't solve problems. They only create more, right?
Yeah.
In many ways. So, yeah, I have not strayed very far from that mindset because, like I say, as soon as it became apparent to me what he was doing and I watched him work, and I was one of those people as well when I first worked with him, thought, well, geez, he's not, you know, what's he doing? It sounds amazing, man, but he's only turned like 8 knobs on the console.
Yeah. Yeah, right, right.
What's happening here, man? And as I began to watch more, because by far the best way to learn is to keep your ears open and your mouth closed, okay, and pay attention, and then later on the side, if you got a minute, ask a question or two. If you've even got any questions at that point, you know, if you haven't sort of figured it out just from paying attention and things like that, I realized where his true genius was, which was, like I say, in setting up the room, choosing the right mic for the right job, using the concept of using a microphone as an equalizer.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Right? Why, if you got a guitar or whatever particular anything that it might be, and if you listen to it and it's a little dull in the control room, well, don't punch that EQ straight away. Go out and move the microphone an inch or two and see what that gives you. Mic it on a different spot on the instrument that's a bit brighter, right? And
yeah,
then go back in and see what you listen to, or just try a different microphone. Try a microphone that's a brighter microphone, right? Rather
yeah
than popping all those EQs. So I learned from him that concept, which again had never dawned on me, right?
Yeah.
At that point
yeah
in time, all those years ago. I mean, we're talking, you know, whatever it is, 25 years ago, right? That microphones are equalizers.
Yeah, yeah, right.
In
right
a way. And the concept of moving the mic a couple of inches, how dramatic a difference that can make.
I have a good story about that, and you'll appreciate it especially. I was producing a band a few years ago, and I hired Ken Scott to engineer the basics for me. And Ken put a C12 on the bass amp, and he looked at me and he smiled and he said, "This is what I used to use on Paul," meaning McCartney. So I'm thinking, wow, never seen that before, but it should sound amazing. And stupid bass player came in and he looked at it and he says, "Why are you doing that? You should be using a D112 on this." And I poked him in the ribs and I said, "Do you realize who you're talking to?" You know, it was just so stupid. And the thing about it is, it really did sound good what Ken was doing, but most people wouldn't even consider using a C12 in a situation like that because they're not the preconceived way that you do these things. But he was just doing it because it sounded good, because he knew it worked, and it certainly did. And that goes to what you're saying, where using the microphone as an EQ and certainly does work, but you have to listen.
Absolutely. And you have to be fearless.
Yeah.
In your pursuit of going against the preconceived norms of what most people would think. Well, why are you using that microphone? Well, because I can, and we're going to give it a shot. We're going to see what happens. It's either going to be a great success or a tragic failure, but there's only one way we're ever going to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is to be fearless and give it a shot. Yeah. And you bring that up about Ken Scott, and on the other side of the coin, right, I've had many discussions with Jeff Emmerich about his approach to Paul's bass.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Which was, again, the same, knocked me out, especially on a lot of the later records, Sgt. Pepper, right?
Yeah.
Where the majority of the bass was done last.
Yeah, I've heard that.
On those records. I said, how did you get that? How did you get the bass sound on that? And again, the exact opposite of what I would have expected the answer to be. You know, an Ampeg B-15 in the middle of the room at Abbey Road number 2, the middle of that giant room, and a single Ampeg B-15 with a figure eight microphone about 5 feet back from the speaker on the amp. And I went, wow, yeah. That's the last thing I ever expected. And yeah, and when you look at it, right, for those records, both equally valid, both equally great sounds at the end of the day,
yeah,
as well, right? But two radically different approaches. And it just goes to show you there is no one. The only thing that's ever the right answer is what works and serves the music the best.
Yeah, yeah,
and
right.
And the track. That's it. That's the only rule, is what works best for what it is we're trying to achieve here in terms of our concept of sound as we make this record or this particular track. That's the only rule. Everything else is up for grabs all the time. Anything is viable.
You know, you mentioned Jeff Emmerich. I'm just curious, is Schmitz and Emmerich's approach the same, or what are the commonalities and what are the differences?
The commonalities are the same old school, and I say old, we say old school these days. I mean, it's not really an accurate term in many ways, because that mode of thinking from back in those days is still as viable and as important today as it ever was. Okay. And mm-hmm. I personally think that it's a shame that the younger generation of people may not necessarily be as fortunate as I was to be exposed to that kind of a thing, right?
Yeah.
So the commonalities are the same basic approach to use the right microphone for the right job. Don't be afraid to get out there and move the microphone, okay? Mm-hmm. Try it in a different spot if it's not working for you. Don't be afraid to grab the mic faders and lift things up or down while you're recording. That same basic sense of fearlessness, that same basic sense of we're capturing a moment in time right now. Okay. Yeah. We're not capturing individual bits. Okay. In other words, in terms of 24 tracks that we're going to assemble into something later, right? Yeah, it's not later, it's now. The immediacy of capturing that moment in time and doing it the best we can at the moment that it's happening. Very much, very, very similar in those respects. The only big difference, I would think, between the two gentlemen is that Jeff tends to use a bit more compression on things than Al does. You know, Jeff is a big fan of the 1176 compressors and the Fairchilds and things like that. And where Al, for the things, and it makes sense when you look at the history of what each gentleman has worked on in the past,
yeah,
as well. You know, it makes Al quite a lot of the big band orchestral jazz influence. I mean, plenty of rock and roll records as well in there, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of the orchestral stuff. Jeff's side of things, a bit more of just sort of the rock and roll, you know, Beatles, Robin Trower, you know, that kind of thing. So the biggest difference I noticed in working with both gentlemen was pretty much just that. The level of compression they would use on things. Mm. Al, very gentle, very subtle, okay, in compression. You know, that's why God gave us faders, right? Why compress something, you know, right, Bobby?
Why
compress something 60 dB when all you have to do is give a fader ride and ride it up where it needs to be or bring it back. It's a much more subtle, it's a gentler way, it's a better sound in the end kind of a concept. Jeff, a little bit more compression just to rein in certain things. But that to me is, there's far more similarities than there are differences, actually.
You okay.
know, because they both come from the same era and the same school,
yeah,
ultimately.
Yeah. What was the craziest session? You don't have to name names, but was there one particular session that you just went, wow, that was really crazy?
Crazy good or crazy bad?
Either way. Either way.
Both sides. Well, it's hard to, pin down those sort of things. Each session, I think, has its ups and downs as you do it, right? As you work, and each thing has its kind of like, oh, this is working great, or, oh, man, this, we got to try something different here. So I think there's a constant flux between it. I could tell you probably some of the most interesting things from just a radical anything goes standpoint would have been when I was working with Yes up in San Luis Obispo, when we were working on the Keys to Ascension records up there, when I was with those guys for months up there. We recorded a lot of live material from a bunch of shows at the Fremont Theater up there, but we also recorded a bunch of quote unquote studio tracks, except the studio was a Wells Fargo bank at the end of the main drag, Marsh Street, which is the main drag through San Luis Obispo. John Anderson, Wells Fargo had moved to a bigger facility down the block a ways, and John rented the bank for a year. So we sort of removed everything from the ground floor, set up the band in there. It was one of these banks where there was a second floor to it, right? Which was open with a bunch of offices, and you could walk out and look down onto the ground floor. So we took over and commandeered two of the offices up there with a connecting door as the control room, quote unquote, threw all the cables over the side, all that stuff down to where the band was, and started. That was our recording space, was a bank, and having to deal with using, that kind of a situation as a recording environment. And having to set things up in a way that didn't require headphones, right? With the drums live in the room with the guys, no isolation at all, except for a couple of baffles around the drum kit, but very wide open, everybody in the same room, no headphones.
Oh, it's awesome.
Being able to get that recorded in a way that was usable and we could fashion into a product that could be released later. And I'll tell you, that instance, as we related, say, back to Al, okay, and even Jeff, right, that instance, the experience I had gained with Al became invaluable.
I bet.
Okay, for that particular thing, which is where to set up the band, how to set up the guys in the room so that the leakage and everything, it was working to your advantage, which was one of the other great things I learned from Al. Okay. Leakage isn't your enemy for the most part. It can be in certain situations, but for most things, leakage is actually your friend,
mm-hmm.
right? The leakage and the spill is what gives records depth and width. And that sort of thing, when everything is a single, isolated, self-contained little thing that you add reverb onto later, you don't get the same impact of depth to the record. It's spatial depth, I mean.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
So a lot of that experience with Al became invaluable in that instance, moving, Steve Howe's guitar amp around till we found right the spot where it worked perfect, moving the bass, Chris Squire's bass rig around, which was pretty loud, as you can imagine, right?
Yeah.
To where that didn't muck with the drums, but then everybody had visual communication. They could hear each other. So all of that experience I had gained in the past paid off a thousandfold in that instance. And then to take those tracks, Bobby, right? And then for John Anderson, the lease runs out that he had, to pick everything up and move it two blocks over to a deconsecrated Catholic church. Okay.
Yeah.
Two blocks over where we mixed. Okay. And that was the mix room. So, you know, I don't see, you know, sessions are what they are. They flow, they ebb. There's high points to them. There's low points. A lot, you know, the musicians, their frame of mind, whoever the particular artist is, there's so many variables that come into play, right,
yeah,
on it, that I think at the end of the day, for me, it's, I don't really quantify them sort of, oh, this was great or this was bad. To me, it's more like what was, like, interesting. In that approach, really. And remembering just to always keep your cool in any situation. That's even more important than anything. You know, when things are all going to hell and, you're right, nothing's working and the gear fails and this and that, how to keep your calm and your composure, and to continue to try to be that positive influence in the room, you know.
Yeah,
in other words,
yeah,
when everyone else is losing their heads, you still are composed enough to continue to drive the ship forward, as they say.
What kind of sessions do you work on today? Do you get sessions because of your association with Al? Or those types of sessions, I mean, because there's so many different ways to record these days. But there are few people that know how to record acoustic music, as you're, you know, we're talking about for the most part. So do you find you get more of that work as a result of your association with Al?
Sure. I definitely get a certain amount of my work through my association with Al. I think in past years, I would like to think, at least, right, that I got a lot of it because of my association with Al, and the fact that for so many years, because, you know, I worked exclusively with Al for the 3 years I was at Capitol, right? Whenever he would work there, I was the only guy he would work with. And then once I left Capitol, Al was gracious enough to call me on the phone and start saying, hey, Bill, I got this gig here or there. Why don't you come along with me and work with me on this stuff? I mean, you know, so we continued to work together in that association for many years, even after I left Capitol. So I think in the outset, in the beginning, Bobby, a lot of it was born out of every time somebody looked in the control room, they saw me standing right next to them.
Yeah.
Right. So it was a lot of guilt by association. And I think initially a lot of that, the work that would come my way was due to that guilt by association factor. These days, I think, or I would like to think that I'm far enough away from that and have now done enough things on my own, right, that it's tipped over to the other side a little bit now.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the work I'm getting is based on the things I have actually done myself.
Yeah.
At this point in time, you know, that I'm far enough removed and have established myself as a standalone entity, if that's the right terminology to use, right?
Yeah, yeah, I get it.
That it has a lot to do with that. But I think at the end, I get the calls that I get for in the same way or method that most everybody else gets it, depending on the people you're associated with in the past. Somebody's recommended you for a job. Right. You worked with one client and you know, oh, you got to get Bill to do this, or people see your names on the back of the records that you have done and they enjoy the sound quality of it or the end result. And, oh, we got to get this guy to do our thing. And so I think in that realm, I'm the same as everybody else. You get the calls you do get from a very wide and varied spectrum. at this point in time, you know, through, like I say, association and the things you've done and recommendations and all kinds of things, you know, or sometimes even other engineers. Hey, I'm booked, you know, on, I got a call to do this, but I'm booked. Can you do this? I know you'll be able to do a good job for these people. And then, you know, go record this and then it'll come back to me and I can, my, you know, I'll be freed up to do the overdubs or the mix on it. And, you know, so there's the cross-pollinization in that way as well.
Got it. Okay, last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've received from somebody or maybe that you've learned along the way?
Always have a smile on your face. Always be happy to be there. The best piece of business advice I ever learned is we've already talked about and touched on a bit, which is attitude. Attitude is everything. Attitude will make or break you. Attitude can give you a career. Attitude can destroy your career. Okay. And that to me is the difference between everything, basically, you know, same as we touched on before, be the positive guy in the room, be somebody that other people want to be around. Okay. Exude that positivity. In the room, be thankful that you're in the room, be grateful that you're in the room and you've gotten the call. Don't ever let any kind of success whatsoever begin to affect you to where you feel you have a right to be in a room or you should be in that room. Everybody is replaceable. And as soon as you begin to lose sight of that, is the minute you start getting replaced, basically, right?
Yeah.
Be that guy, okay? Be that person. That at the end of the day, it's not about the equipment. It's not about the gear. Everybody can set a compressor, okay, in certain ways. Some people may know how to use it more effectively than others. But the gear is all the same, okay?
Yeah.
So it's not the equipment that gets anybody work. It's what you bring, right? It's not the equipment that gets people jobs and gives people a career because we're all dealing with the same tools. So the only thing that separates us is our attitude at the end of the day, you know, because as we said, people will wait, be more than happy to wait a little bit longer to get something accomplished if it's done in a positive fashion, right? You could have the greatest recording engineer in the world, the greatest mixes, but if nobody can stand being around you all day long, eventually that you're going to run out of clients at a certain point. You know, that it can only carry you and sustain you so far. And if you're looking to do this for a living across decades, it's got to be a win-win situation. In other words, you want to have a pleasurable time. I like to enjoy when I'm working well, but my happiness is not as important, if at all, as my client's happiness. Their happiness is the only thing that matters, to continuously remember that you are there to serve the dream and vision of another. It's not about you. It's not about the reverb you're using. It's not about any of your technical skills, maybe a little bit, okay? But the final thing is to always keep the fact that it's about someone else in front of you at all times. Also, to be aware that you can learn something new every single day. And you can learn something new from the places you would never have expected it to come from.
Boy.
And especially this day and age, right? And as we were talking, as it relates to, say, that sort of older approach, right? The sort of old school approach in terms of, as it relates to how the younger guys are doing things these days, I find myself at this point in time really trying to learn from them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As well, right? Because, you know, as you get older, as we do as people and humans, and you do something for X number of years, oh, you know, this is the only way to do it. This is the blah, blah, blah. And that's, you, man, you cut yourself off at the knees as soon as you begin to adopt that philosophy as well. The younger guys and how the younger engineers and younger artists and work these days is so different in many ways than the way we learn.
Yeah, it is.
Right, from years past. And it's different because of the technology and the approach. And they've got such a radically different way of thinking in so many ways that, to me, I at this point in time, I'm always trying to talk to these younger guys about, okay, well, how do you guys do this? Or what's your viewpoint on this? And get, so I can incorporate that into my thing as well, right?
Yeah, because I'm the same way. Yeah.
You want to keep garnering new clients all the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of your, the new clients you're going to, you want to garner are younger people.
Yeah.
Out there, right? You know, because at a certain point you run out of clients that are the same age grouping as you, right? And so you have to sort of go to the tree to pick another apple, as they say, right?
Yeah, you're
so
right.
So that I can, you know, so yeah. I can communicate with them in a way that they understand. And when they're communicating with me, it's also in a way that I can relate to and how they approach things. They have a much more fluid way of working these days, right? Especially with Pro Tools, where it's not necessarily one guy carrying the ball all the way through. You know, they'll fly their Pro Tools sessions around to this guy and he'll do a thing, and this guy and he'll do a thing on it. And I'm not just talking about musicians.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Even
right.
Engineers.
Yeah.
Right? This is an interesting thing, right? I had a discussion with somebody a couple of weeks ago, a younger guy, he's like 22 years old, right? About the concept of mixing and a mixing a song. And, you know, he was saying to me, well, you know, I'll work on a mix and I'll get it to a certain point, and then I send it off to the mix engineer to just sort of sprinkle the fairy dust over the top of it, so to speak, which blew my mind.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Right? Because to me, the concept of a rough mix was something you did in 10 minutes at 2 o'clock in the morning or whenever.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
You just banged it over as a reference, and it was meant nothing. And you would come back and the quote unquote guy mixing the song would start from the ground up and you would do it, as opposed to their way of thinking, which is that the mix is always in play and that the quote unquote rough mix, or what they'll refer to as a rough mix, is something they spent 7 hours on.
Yeah. Right.
Laboring
right.
over.
Yeah.
Right. And that they look into a quote unquote proper mix engineer to just sort of make sure that the balances aren't completely whacked. Right. You know, maybe to do a certain amount of EQ here and there, but not necessarily to build the entire house for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And that, right. The complete opposite of where, say, you and I come from. In our outlook on that. And I sat there thinking, wow.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, right,
you know,
right. No, I'm with you.
That's something to take on board, you know?
For more about Bill, go to billsmith.biz. It's Bill Smith, B-I-L-L-S-M-I-T-H, .biz, B-I-Z. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it in iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.